2000, in which he expressed total non-repentance for the actions that he committed during the war, and he wished he had done more. We're talking about people who believe sincerely in their right to exterminate what they consider the intervention, the subhumans. This is not a scientific concept. It was so enmeshed with spirituality that an SS man, if he had carnal relations with a Jewish woman, was believed to be himself now spiritually polluted just by the contact. So this had no basis in science. This was an esoteric concept that is very old, very ancient, and this is what they were trying to reproduce and to sustain.
Of course, there's a contradiction because there were people in some of the death camps where they had brothels, and some of the SS officers frequented those. And that would have contradicted many of their beliefs, but there were a lot of contradictions. For most people, they understand that some limited number of people within the Third Reich escaped and became hunted, like Joseph Mengele and Martin Bormann, who was never found, and that you probably couldn't name more than five or six if you were the average person, if that. But then we found out that this was not the case, that there were an enormous number of people who were true believers. So apparently the Nazi diaspora to Latin America, the United States, Middle East, and across Asia was not a last-minute desperate attempt of rats to jump ship when it seemed certain that Germany was sinking. Rather, now we know that this was a very carefully orchestrated and planned strategy of escape that involved not only the escape of leaders higher up in the Nazi ranks, in the SS, but billions of dollars worth of currency and gold and other precious metals and gems and art. It was also not just an escape that concerned Nazi war criminals, but also part of the government and military apparatus, businessmen who headed large corporations and bankers, not just those who were held accountable at the Nuremberg trials. And so this was not, for them, the death chant of the Third Reich at the end of World War II. So when you take a look at how many people got out, where they went, and how well they were protected, you couldn't have a normal criminal who had done such abominable actions stay this free for this long, seemingly in countries that we would have known the intelligence apparatuses in these countries, Argentina, Uruguay, Venezuela, Peru. You had them spread all throughout there, Chile. So how for decades upon decades did they manage to cover their tracks and have large communities and have this enormous amount of power and provide us with some of the details of this, such as the Red House meeting, Operation Safe Haven, the infiltration of pro-Nazi business and corporate leaders into the post-war banking and financial system, such as the Bank of International Settlements, which played a fundamental role in the creation of the Third Reich and its relationship with the U.S. Treasury and the American industrial moguls, and what was the agenda of the Nazis as far as the future creation of a post-war Fourth Reich. And then second, that should take you a while on that, but I also want you to segue into discussing, since Germany was now occupied and divided between the West and the Soviet Union, in the East, what was the vision they hope for continuing Hitler's legacy? Or did they want to continue Hitler's legacy?
Well, okay, to start, you mentioned the Red House meeting as an example, the Maison Rouge in Strasbourg, which was a meeting hotly debated, by the way, by historians, that took place, according to documentation that we have, in 1945, but months before the end of the war. This was a meeting of financiers and industrialists, German financiers and industrialists, who were being briefed by an SS officer who was telling them that the end was near, and then it was important to expatriate as much assets of the Reich as possible. But not only the assets in terms of tangible things like gold, jewelry, and valuables, but also to expatriate technology and know-how to other countries around the world, to aid in Germany's rearming as soon as possible after the occupation by the Allies. The idea was to get as much away from the Allied control as possible so Germany would still be able to survive on its own. This meant that companies such as AEG and IG Farben and Krupp and all of the other very famous German corporations like Tyson and the others were able to, and were being told to, expatriate as much of their technology as possible, machinery, engineers, designs, whatever was available, spare parts, raw materials, whatever, to get it out of the grasp of the Allies. And that meant sending it to places like Latin America, the Middle East, Africa, Asia, wherever they possibly could. A United States congressional investigation in the late 1940s revealed that AEG, as an example, had managed to set up more than 400 subsidiary companies around the world in the last year of the war. They had an enormous infrastructure that was outside of Germany, that was still functioning, that was still profitable, that was still doing business. In many cases, doing business with the United States. So you had German firms that had subsidiaries in the United States, and they were funneling money back into the United States through various banks, including, as you mentioned, the Bank of International Settlements. Now, that was an interesting operation. Basically, it was the brainchild of Hjalmar Schacht, a man who was the Hitler's finance minister in the very early days of the Reich. And it was Schacht who was able to work some financial magic to enable Germany to rearm, even though it wasn't supposed to, after the Versailles Treaty and all of the other treaties that followed it, basically forbidding Germany to rearm. Schacht was able to manage to get Germany to rearm anyway by cutting all sorts of deals in other countries for armaments, for money, for training, and everything else. So Schacht and a couple of other people got together and formed this Bank of International Settlements, which was established allegedly to pay Germany's war debt. But by about the time of the crash of 1929, nobody was seriously interested in paying that war debt, and nobody really thought they were going to get paid anyway. So the Bank of International Settlements, BIS, became a kind of money laundering operation for the Reich. Most of the people on the board of directors of that bank were either Germans, or they were heads of banks in German-occupied territory, like Czechoslovakia, for instance. And the head of the bank was an American, Thomas Kittrick. And here was a man who was steadfastly in support of the Reich, of making sure that the finances of the Reich were not in any way harmed by the war. And he actually made speeches back in the United States to American financiers, bankers and industrialists, telling them not to worry about Germany, that their investments in Germany were secure, and that the bank would see to it that nobody was going to lose any money. In fact, they were going to make money. Basically, here was the head of BIS Bank, an American financier, very well known, who was trading with the enemy. I mean, protecting the enemy, laundering the enemy's funds. So much gold went through that bank and then disappeared. We don't really know what happened to all of that money that went through BIS. There's basically no record of it that's reliable. Everything was being done on paper. Everything was being done by telephone calls from a handful of small offices in a former hotel. So you had a bunch of guys sitting around talking on the phone, smoking cigars and cutting deals, and we really don't know the full extent of it. And yet that was one of the banks that served as a kind of money laundering operation for the Reich. But of course, there were many banks in Switzerland other than BIS who were also involved in this. As we know now, in the last few years, there have been a lot of revelations about the extent to which Swiss banks were involved in hiding German money. But where was all that money going? Where was all that gold going? Who was using it? What was the purpose for it? A lot of it was to help restore Germany, of course, but there was a lot more that went to places like Argentina, Paraguay, Chile, that went to the Middle East. There was a famous Swiss financier, François Junot, and here was a man who was a Nazi. He was a Swiss Nazi. He was he idolized Hitler. And at the end of the war, he evidently had access to large sums of money that he was using to finance Middle Eastern nationalist movements in North Africa and the Middle East. In other words, some of the movements that we now know today that were involved in attacks on Israel, attacks on other Western interests in that region, being financed by Swiss financiers like François Junot, and there were others as well. There were arms dealers like Otto Skorzeny, who managed to escape justice at the end of the war, lived out his days in Spain, ran an arms dealing network along with the Swiss financiers and people like Schacht, and was setting up arms dealing and arms training and all sorts of networks of commandos and mercenaries throughout the world. In 1979, when I went to Chile to start my investigation into this aspect of things, I was briefly detained at Colonia Dignidad, which was an estate high up in the Andes Mountains, a few hours south of Santiago by car. And I was detained there for a while. I was allowed to leave after they had photocopied my passport, because they took it away from me. And then years later, it has been revealed after the fall of Pinochet in Chile, when the Chilean democratically elected government got in and started to raid the colony, that it was revealed that Colonia Dignidad was part of a Nazi safe house, a kind of Odessa-like network that spread from South America to Europe, and that they were actually actively engaged in the creation of chemical and biological agents, weapons of mass destruction. And at the same time, we're operating a communication center for Operation Condor, which was the South American assassination organization belonging to Argentina, Chile, Brazil, Paraguay, were all involved with it. It was an organization that basically issued orders for the assassination of people they didn't like, communists, leftists, socialists. The assassination of Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C., or Rene Schneider in Europe, these might have been or were proven to be actions undertaken by Operation Condor, and which had all their tentacles back at Colonia Dignidad, which was also a torture and interrogation center for the Pinochet regime. So this was going on when I went to Chile. It was 1979, and when the estate was finally raided, that was about 10, 12 years ago, I imagine. This is something that was going on till the present day, that unless, you know, until Pinochet left power, I mean, the colony would have been operating at full steam ahead today, under other circumstances. So we know that these organizations existed, that their political agenda, was of course anti-communism. That was foremost in their mind. There was an anti-Semitic element to it, naturally, because of the people who were running this operation. Colonia Dignidad was run by a German former Luftwaffe medical officer. All of his personnel at the estate were German nationals. People had been born and raised in Germany. And he had a new generation of people who were born at the colony, or who were kidnapped children from the towns around Parral, which is where this organization is located. And the children were kidnapped and abused by their leader, and grew up speaking only German and had forgotten how to speak Spanish, because Spanish was not allowed to be spoken at the colony. So this is the kind of mentality we're dealing with. We are dealing with an aggressive, violent network of underground criminals bent on political assassination and in carrying out the dreams of their patrons, which is the Third Reich and the people who were financing them since the very beginning. That gold, that money, that training all came from one source, and it was former SS officers forming what we used to call Odessa, which we sometimes still call Odessa, or the Brotherhood, or the Spider. There's all kinds of names given to the underground networks, and they existed to this day. And in the book that I just published, The Hitler Legacy, there's an appendix which reproduces in its entirety the address book of one of the leaders of this underground movement, a man called Hans Ulrich Rudel. He was Hitler's favorite pilot. He was an ace combat pilot with I think more than 80 kills to his name. And he survived the war and was very popular among the Nazi underground and was sort of their cheerleader. And he made contact with Nazi leaders, neo-Nazis, Nazi apologists, people like David Irving, very famous as a Holocaust denier, people like that all around the world. And his address book has those names, those addresses, and phone numbers, including that of Klaus Barbie. under his pseudonym at the time, Klaus Altman, with his address in Bolivia. So while the world was looking for Barbie, Hans Ulrich Hudel knew exactly where he lived. And you will find in that appendix, in that address book, names of people even living in the United States. And you will find some of those people are still alive to this day.
Most people, Peter, will remember the doctor of death, Joseph Mengele, or Klaus Barbie that you just mentioned, or Adolf Eichmann. But in terms of international preservation of the Nazi cult and ideology, there are thousands upon thousands of people out there, and some, as you mentioned, like Otto Skorzenski, and Hans Rudel, and Schacht, and Genold. These are people who were leaders. These were the alpha males that would have kept things organized.
Sure.
And knowing how important it was for them to be secret, and knowing that they also didn't have any compulsion about killing anyone, they would have had enormous amounts of influence because they could have bought whole areas. They could have bought influence, much like today the Mexican cartels, the seven leading drug cartels, virtually controlled the entire government apparatus in Mexico. Hence, we just saw a group of school teachers protesting. All of them were arrested by the police, turned over to organized crime. They killed them under the direction and the authority of the mayor and his wife. And now that's caused so much protest that now every single police department in Mexico has been taken away from local or state or government jurisdiction at the governor level and turned over to the national federal police because it's so corrupt. But even the federal police are corrupt. The whole corruption of Mexico is just one template of what has happened all over South America and Central America. But the average American doesn't go there to investigate this. They go there to enjoy the beaches or to enjoy the social life or some historical, you know, tour, which is fine, but there's a whole culture. And I'll give you one classic example of this. When I was wanting to see who was bringing in the ganja through the Blue Mountains in Jamaica, I was told that this was an SS operation. That this was people who had set up all these supply points in South America. There was no news of this whatsoever in the American media. And that they were using Jamaica because they controlled the Jamaican government. They controlled the planes that went in, unloaded and reloaded for smaller planes going to the United States. And a person who knew all about this at the time, and I won't mention more about him than to say he lived in Jamaica, he gave me the whole story. I came back and wrote about it, broadcast about it on my ABC show. And he said, be very careful because some of the people who've come down here investigating, they end up drowning. Those are not drownings. You know, that's when word gets out that you threaten them on any level, they will find a way of making it look like you have died accidentally or by suicide. And I said, well, how extensive is this network? And he said, they have people in every single community. They have safe houses in every community. They have legitimate businesses where they have laundered money and set up accounts to show that if you ever audited a business, you would find nothing there. You would find no Jewish money, no gold, nothing that they had taken from the Jews. It would have all been washed. It had been laundered several times and coming through legitimate firms, but those legitimate firms were purchased behind the scenes. The old owners still remain in place as the owners, but they're not in power. They were important to keep their name out of the news, to keep them out of publicity. They did not have any of the open ceremonies. And as a result, they have protectors everywhere. They have thousands and thousands of protectors. And I said, you mean in Jamaica? He said, no, not just in Jamaica, in every country in Central and South America. They especially are good at getting into intelligence agencies, into security services, into justice departments, attorney general's departments, because then if there's an investigation coming from a country like Israel or the United States, they will know about it, and they can warn people, and they can thwart it, as they did trying to hide Eichmann, for example, for a long time, and as they successfully hid Joseph Mengele. Mengele was never discovered. He was never captured. Now, does that in any way reconcile with your research?
Well, it more than reconciles. I mean, it's just another example of what I personally saw, what I personally have been investigating in Europe and in Latin America and Asia. The networks are extremely powerful. They're heavily financed. The first thing we have to remember is that most of the stolen Nazi gold has never been recovered. And with gold prices what they are today, that's we're talking about a sizable fortune that can be used to finance almost anything. And we're thinking, okay, that was 1945. This is it's a long time since then. It's 70 years. Is it, you know, how could all of this have existed for that long? And it's quite simple. You know, new generations rose up of true believers. There are some old ones still alive. Some of the old tigers of the Reich are still around, but some of the younger ones also are still around. New generation of people who were brought up in this particular ideology, they may have changed it slightly here and there since then, changed its manifestation. They may not dance around in stormtrooper uniforms and jackboots, but they still are true believers, and they're in charge of the money. They're in charge of the agendas. The agenda now is slightly changed since the fall of the Soviet Union. That was one of the major enemies of the Reich that they wanted to eradicate. Their next target, of course, is the United States and capitalist countries in general. So we're talking about a network of thousands of people who escaped at the end of the war, not just the high-profile ones, as you mentioned. Those were the leaders. Those were the ones that had to really stay underground because they were being hunted. But you have someone like Klaus Barbie, for instance, the butcher of Lyon, a man responsible for all sorts of war crimes, who found a very nice berth in Bolivia, who eventually came to run the secret police of Bolivia. He had an actual important official position in the Bolivian government. And during this time, he created something called the Fiancés of Death, which was a kind of an underground network that dealt in arms dealing and assassinations. And at this point now, we believe in drug dealing, human trafficking, and other types of operations. Klaus Barbie's network extended throughout Latin America. He had people working for him who were too young to have been in the war, but they were Germans. They were people of German ancestry who grew up in German communities in Latin America who were very pro-Nazi, who had been during the war. If we remember, Argentina, Chile, very late to declare war on Germany until almost the last minute. They were serving as conduits for German financing, but also as safe harbors for U-boat traffic and for other types of material support for the Reich. So we had a strong infrastructure already in place in Latin America and in the United States, by the way, a strong infrastructure already there of like-minded people, of fellow travelers, of people who wanted to see the Reich succeed, who idolized Hitler, who idolized the SS, who idolized the religious, you might say, ideology of Nazism, already in place, already working to help the underground, to help the people move through the safe houses, move through the networks of safe houses and sanctuaries all throughout the world, to finance them and to set them up in businesses and to make alliances with political leaders. I mean, Juan Perón was probably the most notorious of these alliances, but you had Stroessner in Paraguay as well. And if you look at Rudolf's address book, you'll find Stroessner's family mentioned in there. They're there with their names, addresses, and phone numbers, and all sorts of intelligentsia and financiers and industrialists of Paraguayan society are listed in there, as well as people, addresses in Argentina, Chile, and elsewhere. These were not German people, necessarily. These were local people who grew up idolizing Hitler, idolizing the ideology of the Reich, and now they were more than happy to cooperate with people like Rudel and Skorzeny and some of the other arms dealers and people around the world because of their anti-communist position. Remember, the United States threw a lot of energy behind military dictatorships back in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s that we saw as anti-communist. So we backed Pinochet. We made sure that Allende would not survive very long, put Pinochet in power and supported him. The same with the generals in Argentina and in Brazil. The same with Marcos in the Philippines and Sukarno in Indonesia. So we were putting a lot of effort behind these people who were not Germans. They were not Aryans, but they were fellow travelers. They idolized the ideals of the Reich, and so they became a kind of addition or extension of the Third Reich. So when we talk about the networks, the undergrounds, we're not only talking about a bunch of old guys who are now in their 90s who are dying off one by one. We're talking about the networks they helped to create as well. We moved thousands of people, even the United States. We brought in hundreds and hundreds of scientists in for Operation Paperclip, for example. We hired hundreds and hundreds more, if not thousands more, in Germany to spy on on the Soviet Union and the satellite countries of Eastern Europe under the Galen organization, which then became the CIA's East European desk until it became the West German Intelligence Service. So we had financed Nazis. We supported them ourselves. We brought people over. There's been a lot of research on this subject. There's a lot of controversy surrounding it, of course. But our knowledge of Barbie's escape is documented. We knew that he had worked for us, basically, in Europe before we got him to Bolivia. We knew that Walter Rauch was in Chile. We knew that Erich Priebke was in Chile. We knew that Barbie was in Bolivia. We knew a lot of this already. We were very much aware of the escape of the Nazi war criminals. But again, we're only talking about the rock stars, the famous names. What we never see, what we never really pay too much attention to, are the thousands of war criminals, the thousands of SS officers who escaped, who spread throughout the world. We had SS officers and other war criminals in Egypt during Nasser's regime building rockets to attack Israel and training the secret police in Egypt in interrogation techniques. We had, of course, Alois Brunner, the man they say died 4 years ago in Syria. He was training the secret police in torture and interrogation in Syria. We had other Germans in Chile at Colonia Dignidad doing the same thing, teaching torture and interrogation techniques. This was their expertise as members of the SS, people who ran the concentration camps. They ported this knowledge to other parts of the world that would benefit by it, regimes that they supported. You never saw them supporting communist regimes unless there was something in it for them, unless they were going to make some money on the deal or maybe play both sides against the middle. But for the most part, these were true believers, anti-communists, anti-Zionists, anti-Semites. And they carried this program throughout the decades after the war. And as I insist in the Hitler legacy, their influence is to be felt today, especially in what we're calling today Islamist terrorism or global jihad.
Peter, that brings me to another issue I'd like to address with you. But let us also remember, as early as 1942, many in the SS and many top bankers and industrialists within Germany thought it was insane what Hitler was doing with a relatively small group of his generals in the attack on Russia. They saw the consequences, and they started to form alliances and movements with years of planning and unlimited amounts of money that they had stolen from the Jews out of the country. So not everyone who left and was a part of the movement of these thousands was pro-Hitler or pro the SS. They were opportunists. They saw that there was new markets, new opportunity, new wealth they could have. They may have some philosophical alliance with some aspects of this, but these were not all true believers. They were pragmatists, many of them as well. Now, you mentioned a bank that was funneling the money for these and the Krupps and the others during the war, the bank is International Bank of Settlements. You realize that today that's the most powerful bank in the world, more powerful than the Federal Reserve, more powerful than the World Bank, the international banks, including the European Central Bank, because it's the one that is the banker's bank. That's what it's called. So if it still has influence and the legacy of all of these people, when you create something or you have power in them, you nurture the next generation. So when you step aside, the next group of people are not going to alter how the control goes, and they care about the control. One time someone said to me in an argument about, well, it's the Rothschilds. And I said, well, show me the Rothschild name. Show me the Rockefeller name. You won't see the Rothschild name and Rockefeller name on very many things. But do you know how many insurance companies and in how many banks and how many other major industries they have controlling interest in the stock and therefore have their supporters on the board of directors to determine the fate and the direction of that board? They don't want the publicity. They don't want to put a target on themselves for criticism, but that doesn't mean they don't have the influence. It's just a shadow influence. So that said, how powerful today, as we're speaking, do you believe that some of these previous Nazi sympathizers are in international banking, and it would appear that the Nazis developed a fine-tuned machine for manipulating international banking laws and transferring funds and gold and for running weapons and drugs and other illegal merchandise through shadow banking channels. And also, would you speak about the legacy of hidden Nazi and Japanese gold, which today would be valued at possibly as much as $100 billion by today's market. And as you mentioned, and has been accurately stated, the vast majority of wealth was never found. And yet there are still reports about intrigues and assassinations. And tell us about that, please.
Well, sure. I mean, what you said is absolutely correct. There were many pragmatists. I mean, they tried to kill Hitler so many times. His own generals tried to kill him. The famous Operation Valkyrie after the D-Day invasion in 1944 is just one example. So there was a definite divide between the real army and the SS, who were considered to be fanatics. But I think the pragmatic people that you were mentioning just now, the Germans who thought that Hitler was insane, especially after the invasion of Russia, they still had Germany's best interests at heart. And what they wanted to do was preserve Germany's integrity after the war, in whatever means they could. And the large corporations, like we mentioned, Tyson, Krupp, AEG, and all the others, these were organizations that were going to survive no matter what, and they would make whatever accommodations they had to make to ensure that their technology survived, that their financing survived, that their profits survived. But the SS and the true believers that I write about, these are the people who would do the dirty deeds that had to be done. You didn't find the corporate types going out there and shooting their enemies, but the SS could be counted on to provide those services. So if someone had to be gotten rid of, if someone, for instance, as you mentioned about your Jamaican episode, if someone had to be killed and made to look like a suicide or made to look like an accident, these are the guys you called, because these were the specialists and that sort of thing. So this was the violent shock troops for the German corporations when they needed it, whether it was to solve a union problem in some small town in South America, whether it was to conduct business with an Arab official in Egypt, or whatever it might happen to be. You relied upon these men, the hard men, to do the hard work, and then the corporate people would go on unperturbed. And I think this was an alliance between the two, and it was the same alliance that existed in Germany during the war. The industrialists supported Hitler, backed Hitler, not because they were true believers necessarily, but they saw that Hitler was going to be the best person for the job of restoring Germany's power. Now, remember, as you said about the BIS, that Bank of International Settlements is the most powerful bank in the world, the banker's bank, as you said. And what's happened in recent years? What we have is exactly what the Germans at the Strasbourg Conference in 1945 were talking about. They were talking about restoring Germany's greatness. They were talking about reunifying Germany. Once the war dust had settled, the Soviet Union occupied half of the country and the Allies occupied the other half, and Berlin was a divided city. It was the dream of the Nazis to reunify Germany and make Germany once again the most powerful country in Europe. And this is basically what they're doing. They're not doing it so far with guns. They've done it with economics. They've created the European Union. They put Germany at the forefront of this. Germany's been reunited. The Soviet Union has fell. All of these were part of all these items were on the agenda at the Strasbourg Conference and at other conferences similar to that in the years at the end of the war and the years following the war. There were many groups within Austria and Germany that had these as their stated items of action. The Naumann Circle, for instance, in Vienna, in Austria, which was broken up by British intelligence, was being run by former Nazis and a former general in the Wehrmacht, who was actually responsible for having the perpetrators of Operation Valkyrie arrested, talking about the General Remmer. Remmer managed to skate free from a lot of the accusations against him and became a major figure in the Nazi underground, attending meetings all over the world, including in the United States, talking to various extreme right-wing groups, and keeping the home fires burning. These were people who would do the hard things in order that the corporations could thrive and exist, and that their ultimate goal would be achieved. And part of that ultimate goal is still the weakening of the United States as a military and economic power in the world, and Germany taking its place.
Peter, we're running out of time, and I want to get this concept in. And it's just a hypothesis. It's very subjective. But one of the more fascinating legacies of the Germans from the past two world wars has been the birth of what now is a form of Islamic global or worldwide jihad. We've always thought of the Islamic jihad against Western economic and military colonialism and materialism and secular culture as a phenomena born within Islam, and in particular within the literal interpretation of the Quran, such as the more fundamentalist Muslim sects of Wahhabism or the Muslim Brotherhood. So give us your interpretation if you find that there's validity to this, simply because during the Second World War and afterwards, you had Nazis living in the Middle East or fleeing to the Middle East after the Nazi diaspora. And the Reich had developed very close ties to the Middle East and North African countries and dictatorships. You mentioned Nasser's Egyptian missile program was worked on by the Nazis. Have you discovered that these Nazis influenced the fundamentalist Islamists to do the dirty work out front, so to speak, to get them to be the front, or is that too far of a stretch?
No, there's absolutely no question in my mind after reviewing all the available documentation. The concept itself of global jihad was not an Islamic one. It was actually created by a German archaeologist in World War I, a man called Max von Oppenheim, who actually was a descendant of the Jewish Oppenheim family. He lived in the Middle East for a very long time. He considered himself an expert on Islam and on the Middle East, and he convinced the Kaiser to convince the Sultan of Turkey, or the Ottoman Empire, to join forces with Germany against Britain, France, and Russia. And in order to do so, the Sultan was convinced to declare the first ever global jihad. Now, jihad, of course, exists in Islam since the very beginning, the concept of struggle, but it's mostly a struggle against somebody who's right in front of you, doing something against you or against one of your friends or your family, or it's a more spiritual concept of struggle. These can be interpreted different ways. But a global jihad, a call to all Muslims around the world to attack all the unbelievers, was this brainchild of Max von Oppenheim. And the Sultan then issued a fatwa telling all Muslims worldwide to rise up against their colonial oppressors, particularly the British, the French, and the Russians. This didn't really work, as we know. We know what happened to the Arab revolt. Arab tribes fought each other. They fought the Turks. There was no unity among the Arabs or among the Muslim populations in general where this was concerned. It sort of failed. But then in the 1920s, with the Balfour Declaration, with the creation of the State of Israel, or the Palestine mandate that the British were in control of at that time, and a lot of anti-European sentiment because the Arab revolt was betrayed by the Sykes-Picot Agreement and various other things that had happened we don't have time to get into. But there was the growth, there was the emergence of leaders like the Amir al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who hated the colonial powers, and who also hated the fact that there was going to be a Jewish state created in the midst of Palestine. He formed alliances with Nazis. Eichmann actually went to the Middle East to talk to the Grand Mufti and to form alliances with the anti-Jewish Arab nationalist groups in the Middle East. And then during the war, the Grand Mufti himself went from the Middle East to meet with Hitler, to meet with Himmler. They helped form the Bosnian Muslim SS division. All of this was done because the idea was we're going to unite all the Muslims against the evil powers, the Western capitalist powers, and against Israel. This was the idea. The Grand Mufti, Amir al-Husseini, he survived the war for decades. He didn't die until the 1970s. He went around the world trying to raise consciousness and to create a Muslim alliance against the countries of the West from his early days as a supporter of Nazism, as a person who lived in Berlin during the war. He had an estate thrown at his disposal, had a villa that he operated out of, sending radio broadcasts to the Middle East. This was, part of the Nazi agenda. The idea was to raise up the Arab populations, Muslim or Christian or whatever, against the English, against the French, to throw them out and to seize the Suez Canal. This all went back to oil. It went back to transportation, of course. The Nazis were not enamored of Islam at the time. And yet, at the end of the war, hundreds of Germans, Nazis and all Nazis, but some SS, some Wehrmacht, wound up in Middle Eastern countries, and many actually converted to Islam and lived the rest of their days in Muslim countries as staunch supporters of these Muslim countries, especially in the fight against Israel and the fight against the West.
Okay, well, I'm just thinking back to all of the people who were famous, like Henry Ford, Averell Harriman, Prescott Bush, George Bush's grandpa, who were very supportive of Hitler in his earlier days. And I'm looking today at how you would see something if it had been washed through so many filters of history so that no one would associate it all with Nazi sympathizers. But then you look, and you look at George H. Bush relied heavily upon what was known as the Heritage Group Council, which was an entire emigre group of former Nazi sympathizers from Eastern Europe countries like the Ukraine and Belarusia and Slovakia and the SS Cossack Division and the Romanian Iron Guard and the Itaim P2 Fascist Lodge that was linked to the 1980 Bologna train station bombing. Would you share any of this? Because this is also part of the legacy.
Well, this is the thing. I've often been criticized for linking the extreme right in the United States, and even members of the more mainline Republican Party, with support for Nazism. This is considered sort of tabloid style journalism. But I'm sorry, the documents point only in that direction. The World Anti-Communist League is a very good example of this. Ronald Reagan was very close to the World Anti-Communist League and to the Captive Nations organizations, as well as to the Heritage Group. All of these people had formed alliances with ex-Nazis. I mean, people who had been Nazis in the war, not only Germans, but Romanians and Greeks and people from the other Eastern European countries and Asians. I mean, there were fascists in Taiwan, of course. There were fascists everywhere who were siding on the side of the Nazis. This was something that, because they were anti-communists, once again we get back to the same theme, because of the anti-communism, the violent anti-communism of these groups, they were considered allies of the extreme right in the United States. People like Henry Ford, of course, was a notorious anti-Semite. I mean, his writings prove that. His award by Hitler of the highest decoration you can give to a foreigner at the Third Reich is another example of that. Henry Ford and Mussolini got it in the same year. I mean, this is a mentality of which we must be aware. This is a kind of an attitude that says, this kind of right-wing extremism is okay, it's acceptable, because we have to do these hard things to fight the Soviets or to fight the communists, or these days to fight the terrorists or the Muslims or whatever is the new flavor of the week. This kind of extreme attitude is what is characteristic of what I call the Hitler legacy. And it's not just an idea, a vague philosophical notion. As you pointed out, the actual personalities keep cropping up in alliances, forming alliances with each other for these political ends.
Peter, we're out of time. From Florida on Skype, yes. Peter Lavenda. His book is The Hitler Legacy, The Nazi Call to Diaspora, How It Was Organized, How It Was Funded, Why It Remains a Threat to Global Security in the Age of Terrorism. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour and Conversations with Remarkable Minds. Thank you very much for listening.
Hi, I'm David Kenny, inviting you to join me Sunday, December 14th at 3 p.m. for the Everything Old is New Again Holiday Concert. It's a benefit for WBAI at the Metropolitan Room at 34 West 22nd Street in Manhattan. Lots of great talent, great music, door prizes, giveaways, and more. That's the Everything Old is New Again holiday concert on Sunday, December 14th at 3 p.m. For more information and to buy tickets, go to give2wbai.org. That's give, the number 2, wbai.org. Come and enjoy.
Why are you so sad? It's almost time for Christmas.
My family doesn't celebrate Christmas.
Oh, Jewish?
Uh-uh.
Muslim?
Uh-uh.
Buddhist?
Nope. My family doesn't practice any religion, and we don't believe in things that are supernatural.
But haven't they heard? There are many ways to enjoy and celebrate Christmas that are completely naturalistic.
Really?
Really, and this Christmas, they can learn all about having a perfectly wonderful naturalistic Christmas on Equal Time for Free Thoughts Naturalistic Christmas Special.
Naturalistic Christmas Special?
That's right.
When?
From 3 to 5 on Christmas Day.
3 to 5 Christmas Day.
Right here on 99.5 WBAI.
The WBAI University of the Air will present on Tuesday, December 9th, starting at 7 p.m., a forum discussing the new film by Laura Poitras, Citizen 4, on the Edward Snowden revelations on U.S. government surveillance. This will be held at 388 Atlantic Avenue between Hoyt and Bond Street at WBAI's offices at the Commons. Again on Tuesday night, December 9th, starting at 7 p.m., the WBAI University of the Air will present a forum on the impact of Citizen 4, the new documentary by Laura Poitras about the Snowden revelations. The forum will be held at 388 Atlantic Avenue between Hoyt and Bond Street at the Commons, where WBAI is located in Brooklyn. All are welcome.
Hi, I'm Gary Knoll. I'd like to invite you to a special fundraising world premiere of a new film, Poverty, Inc., getting to the bottom of all the income inequality issues from all around the world. It was filmed over 5 years. It's going to be premiering the week of December 5th through the 11th. There'll be 35 showings at the Quad Theater. It is a fundraiser for WBAI. We have the leading voices, Jim Garrison and Dennis Halliday, Chris Hedges, Michael Hudson, Harvey Cox, Professor Emeritus, Harvard Divinity School, Gerald Salante, all the leading voices, over 60 major voices speaking out against poverty. Come and watch this unique film and select which specific performance you'd like to be at. There'll be panelists there. There'll be discussions afterwards. Call 877-627-5065. That's 877-627-5065.
And the previous program was the Gary Knoll Show. Gary Knoll is heard Monday through Friday at noon here on WBAI. Now stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille. And once again, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Everybody, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. In the studio with me today, Ben and Julian. Here we are again, getting to work.
Yes, we are.
All right. Now listen, we were picking up on a program that we heard yesterday, or I heard on Sunday. There was this issue that was brought up by Joel Osteen, where I heard him do a program about honoring. It was called Honoring People. And the basic idea of this program was that he said it is important to be able to say something good about people. That's what he called honoring, either saying it directly to them or saying it to other people about them. And the opposite of that is never speaking badly about them. Well, I kind of took this concept and we ran with it a little bit. And we got some callers, at which you could be calling in as well, 212-957-2729. And we were going to work with this a little further. We started off with that. We started off with that. And
just the concept of honor and how in little ways we can show others through our actions and our words that they matter to us, making people feel special and making people feel appreciated. And when we got towards the end of the program, we were talking about the notion of talking good behind someone's back versus the sort of classic gossip example of talking badly behind someone's back.
Try to imagine, my friends, try to imagine a group of people speaking good about somebody who's not there. What would that be like? If it weren't a cult, what would it be like?
I think it'd be a very positive thing.
Imagine. Oh, yeah, he's a wonderful guy. Yes, 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 you know, I know he's generous. He does this. He does. You just generally don't hear people doing that. For some people, for some reason or other, people get more mileage out of talking badly about someone, meaning mentioning their shortcomings or mentioning what's wrong with them.
I think that by doing that, sometimes people can feel like they are elevating themselves by bringing someone else to a lower position. And so maybe the reason you don't hear the inverse is that by making someone look too good, maybe we don't feel like we look as good in comparison.
So if you could see somebody wearing a short skirt and you could criticize them for wearing the short skirt, you could say, look at him. And you can say any number of things that would criticize the person and would criticize them because you weren't feeling as good in your own short skirt.
Right.
Okay, that's one. So one would say that maybe there's some instinctive drive that helps you survive. If you're going to be critical about something, you're going to be able to spot the weaknesses. And by sharing the weaknesses of the other person, it empowers you in some way.
Sure.
It kind of reminds me of a bunch of, like, little fish in the ocean looking for the wound on a shark, you know? They're looking for his little spot we could go after.
Definitely. And I think it's a great metaphor because you're talking about little fish looking at this bigger fish. And in general, from my experience, the bigger the person, the more powerful the person, the more satisfying it is for people to bring them down, to verbally tear them down. And we see that. I mean, there's a whole industry devoted to gossiping about celebrities. You know, there's magazines, television shows that are all about, you know, dishing the latest dirt on, you know, this actress or that singer or this politician.
And gossip, the very word gossip comes from, where did we learn it came from?
It came from Old English. It's a combination of two words, I think.
Which had something to do with godfathering or something like that.
Right.
You know, but it's always perceived as a negative. So there is no such thing as positive gossip. But it's strange.
Well, the very word gossip does carry a negative connotation. So in essence, when we say gossip, it's almost, yeah, you're right, it's almost impossible for it to be positive. But maybe, you know, could we imagine a positive gossip? I mean, what would that entail?
Imagine a group of people sitting around talking about WBAI, the radio station, and they were saying, let's say, good things about the radio station, right? And everybody, or let's say they were talking about The Positive Mind, the radio program, and a group of people were talking about it. Almost everyone would do it, except there would always be one or two people that want to be different. They want to set themselves aside. They want to feel a little beyond it. Because they believe if everybody is complimenting any one thing, it creates a family. And they don't want to be just another person in the family. They want to be special. So they're going to be antagonistic.
They want to stand out.
They want to stand out. So you find that often with negativism in people. You know, it's a way of just standing out.
So then why is it, though, that if there's a group of people speaking negatively and gossiping that, you know, you don't more often hear the standout person in the group coming to said person's defense? You see what I mean?
Sure.
Because I agree with what you say. If there were people speaking positively, there's always going to be one or two people who want to have a dissenting opinion and sort of be the negative one. But why don't we see the opposite as much when people speak negatively?
Imagine a group of hyenas eating a carcass, right? And somebody comes along and says, "Oh, I knew that carcass, right? Let me take them out to say hello." Well, you know, the other group is going to be angry because they're feeding.
Right.
They're feeding. They know, "Oh, don't do this now because we're in the middle of our frenzy."
It's an incredible image. It makes sense, though. I see it.
So speaking badly about your mates, speaking badly about other people that you know, this is what we want to change. Now, this means that we're exploring the issue of where we could make a difference in life, and where we could all make a difference is to say something well about someone. And what I found interesting about the program, although, again, this is not... I'm not saying that I think Joel Osteen is doing a complete job there, because I see him missing in quite a few spots, especially his jokes. His jokes seem to tear down everything he believes in, you know. But beyond that, he had a message in there, and the message in there is that we must in somehow honor each other, honor people that don't get honored, and that will come back to us manyfold. And it's just amazing how few people do it.
And how little it actually takes to do it. I mean, how simple it can be to make someone feel appreciated just by calling them. Pick up the phone and say, "Hey, you know, I'm thinking about you. Hope you're doing well." That really doesn't take very much energy.
You know, it's also interesting, Ben, when you do something specific when you call them. I was thinking about the way you like to play bocce ball. Right? And I was thinking about bocce ball and playing bocce ball with you, and it really reminded me. And I remember the time we did it. I was just thinking about it. Not that we should get together and do it again, but I love the way you do it. I like the way you think. I like the way you breathe. I like the way you talk. I like the way you read that poem. A specific thing about a person that you could say. I love your creativity. I love the way you dress. I like, you know, something that you could say very specific in recognition of a person.
Sure. I mean, it starts small. I mean, when I think about this, and then the notion of making someone feel good, I think about what is the smallest unit of this action that I can take in a way. So first I try to think what's just something that I like about this person. And it could be very simple. Like you said, the way they think or the way they speak. And what is it about, you know, what are the qualities about them that I admire? And I think when you put yourself in that sort of mind frame of compassion and framing it that way, it makes it easier to reach out to them, you know, in a human way and make that connection.
So it should be an effort today. I wonder how many of you out there could join us in this, in trying to see if there's one person, one place that you could put out one piece of positive energy. Positive meaning you're going to say something to the other person. Now, Ben, you use a phrase to make them feel better. Not even to make them feel better, but to make yourself feel better because you did something white. You did something, oh, God, I'm going to get letters about that. You did something nice, right? You did something nice. You did something pleasant. You did something that enhanced in some way, reminding somebody of something that you like, complimenting somebody, or not even complimenting them to someone else, saying something nice about them. Speaking badly about people becomes something that people get used to as long as you're within a certain organization. But, you know, there are certain organizations that kind of hold very tight.
What do you mean by organizations?
Well, think about the mafia, you know, Omerta.
Code of silence.
A code of silence, which basically means if you have something bad to say, you can say it within the family, but you can't say it outside the family.
Right.
Now, the rule of that is you absolutely avoid interfering in the business of somebody else. That's rule number one. Prohibition of cooperation with any state authorities or reliance on its services, even if it means for medical help. You just like you're saying, I reject the outside. We're all going to do this at home. You know, what's the Pennsylvania?
We're going to handle our business in-house.
In-house, right. So Christian Scientists, right?
Yeah.
Right? They said, we're going to do it. We're going to do it in here. We're going to be this way. The Mormon in general.
Yeah, I mean, any kind of tight-knit religious organization or cult, I think, would handle it like that.
And the belief is that if you go outside, you've committed a crime because you've agreed to the rules of staying within the family.
Right, and then it creates this sort of definition of insiders and outsiders, and it draws very clear lines, who is a part and who is not. And then it creates a sort of insular kind of us versus them mentality, us against the world in a way.
So where do you stand with the world, my friends? Where do you stand in your relationship to people at 212-957-2729? 212-957-2729. Where do you stand in your being able to share some good words about someone, even now? I mean, even if I could tell you the number of letters we receive positively about this program and about WBAI, it's remarkable. It's remarkable. And those words are kept, you know, in emails and in text messages, but rarely said, almost like you can't say it on the air. You can't say it to each other. You know, so we're going to be exploring this with
you
today.
And it's always great to get feedback from listeners, whether it's an email or a phone call. We're also on Twitter now. Armand has a Twitter, and it's at Armand DeMille, and you can always send in your thoughts on the program or in general. That's at Armand DeMille, D-I-M-E-L-E.
Okay, we have Catherine on the line. Hi, Catherine. This is Armand DeMille.
Hi. I wanted to tell you my grandmother trained me well in this. She had a game called Trade Last when she would tell me someone else had said something nice about me. Before she would tell it to me, I would have to tell her something nice about her. And it's called a trade last. And also on Thanksgiving, I visited a shut-in, and she was complaining about people so much I got a headache. So I think I'm well with you on the positive talk, and I thank you for your show.
Oh, wait a minute. How did your grandmother teach you to do this? Teach me it again. What did she teach you to do?
Well, we're from Chicago, and it's called a trade last. And she'd say, Catherine, I have a trade last for you.
What's the last word? Trade. What's the last word? Trade last?
Yeah, L-A-S-T. She would tell me my compliment she heard about me, but she would tell me last.
Give me an example.
I would have to go first and tell her something.
Oh, I see. So give me an example of that, would you, Catherine?
Sure. I would say, my mother told me that your gravy is the best Thanksgiving gravy. And then she would say, oh, I saw Mrs. Bray downtown, and she told me that you had such good manners the other day.
Wow. Wow. And that worked.
Well, I think that it really did, because people tell me that they enjoy being with me, that I have a positive attitude, and I'm grateful for that.
So if I trade lasted you right now, right?
Yes.
I have something good to say about you that I heard from someone else, but I didn't hear anything from someone else. What if I just had something good to say about you?
Well, that's so tricky. I don't really understand it, but I did hear about trade last on a public radio show called Way with Words, and other people in the world do trade last, but it's bizarre to me because I only thought Grandma and I did it.
Well, how would you do it with WBAI Radio with the positive mind?
Well, my daughter and I were in the car, and she was saying that she's glad I listened to your radio show, so I might be able to say something like that.
So your daughter said that she was glad you were able to listen to the radio program, right?
Right. She loves the whole radio station.
And Julian was just nodding to me as he was listening to your voice about your voice. He said you sounded great.
Aw, well, God bless you, and thank you very much.
You've got a good energy, and you sound real. Thank you very much for calling in.
You're welcome. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Trade last, huh? Not bad. Nice. Nice teaching from a grandma. 212-957-2729.
Hi, this is Julian with Positive Mind.
So it seems that people do have experience with it.
Okay, I'm hearing an echo.
It's definitely an interesting concept. I'd never heard of it, but it's really exactly in line with what we're talking about. It's great that that was our first call to hear about that.
I'll tell you something that somebody said good about you, but I'm not going to tell you until you tell me something that you heard good about me.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Well, all right, let's do it.
You want to start?
Yeah.
I'll start or you start?
Well, I said it. I'll start.
Okay.
That means you go first.
Oh, that means I go first. Well, Julian and I were walking down the street the other day, and Julian said, you know, it's amazing how perceptive Armand is, just how he's able to sort of read people. Now, this is something that we've both said to each other in the past, but he happened to tell me the other day, and I agree.
Julian told me, that you got along really well with those neighbors of mine, and he said they really liked you a lot.
Okay.
I like how I'm always involved in these trade labs.
So far, we got you. You're the third in our family. Good. 212-279. This is Jay is on the line. Hi there, Jay. It's Armand DeMille.
Hi, Armand. Thanks for picking up my call. You know, I listen to your show as often as I can. I always enjoyed a great deal. It's very insightful. Just to throw that out first, and I wanted to make one point. Listening to, you know, the opinion on, you know, voices that are, you know, considered dissenting, you know, voices, you know, people who sort of almost pathologically wish to present a side on an issue just because it doesn't go against, you know, just because it goes against the mainstream. And I wondered that just as often as we have people who create that offense, who will be, you know, the odd man out just because they want to be noticed or because that, you know, that being the dissenting voice is the unique voice. I think on the other side is that we fall prey so much in this life with groupthink, that is people who are happy to go along with, you know, whatever the popular, you know, thought is just because, you know, we feel good to be part of that group.
Mm-hmm. Good thinking.
And I wondered, is it necessary to equate, you know, an opinionated voice with one that is an unhappy voice? In other words, can you be critical and can you stand away from the group think, which is so popular, and still possess a positive voice?
Well, I know you know the answer to this, Jay.
Yeah, I do know the answer.
You do know. So tell me the answer to it.
Well, the answer is, I think, you know, I tend to be that voice in a group. You know, through my life, I can remember instance after instance where I get looks at a table, you have to destroy what we were all feeling. Why did you come in, you know, with that voice? I am that voice. So, yes, I do know the answer. And that voice isn't always the result of feeling, you know, negative or because I need to stand out, but it's more often because I think sometimes groups need to be supported because they're taking too much comfort in feeling the easiness of everybody feeling the same way. And there's no end to abuses to how that works, right? I mean, you know, everything from the religious group you belong to the political group you belong to. I mean, you know, what could be more necessary?
Well, you know, the only problem, Jay, is sometimes it's like a warm fart in a cold breeze.
Good.
You know what I mean? I mean, you're sitting around with a group of people, and they're having this nice, wonderful time, and they're having this, you know, going on this positive string. Now, you want to bring that in, but it's timing. It's all about timing.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like all of a sudden they look at you and they, oh, what does that smell?
Mm-hmm.
You see, it's just about timing, because I know you know the answer to it. I know that you're not a negative guy.
No,
I know
really
that
not.
you want to present an oppositional position, you know, or a position that may not agree with them, but it's about timing, how you do it. And first of all, acknowledging what people are doing first is important. Hey, yes, I see that point of view. And if you take the word but out of your vocabulary, but mm-hmm. is usually meant to cancel whatever it was that was being said, but instead you put the word and, it helps you introduce a subject that may be antagonistic on some level, but not. perceived as negative.
Yeah, I mean that starts to turn to the the aspect of a well-mannered.
But do you ever feel like you're falling asleep when you hear a group of people talking all about the same thing in the same positive way, and you just feel like you're getting a little dreary and you just, and that's probably what comes behind it. You get restless, you get bored, and that's why you decide to jump in.
I think I tend to rather be enamored of folks who, have another an opinion, another voice. Even if they're a little off, I'm much more comforted by hearing the one opinion that I hadn't thought of. I might take that opinion and not agree with it, but I say to myself, it's sort of refreshing that you stood up and made an opinion that belongs to yours and not the group.
Sure, sure. An opinion could be a flag that somebody's waving rather than a grenade being thrown in the middle of a bunch.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'll leave and let someone else talk, but I remember sitting at a dinner table last year with about 12 people, and they got on the subject of Scientology. None of them were Scientologists. Mm-hmm. I'm not a Scientologist. And frankly, I only know what I read about it. But these people were so adamant that it was a dangerous cult and that it had to be avoided at all costs. And I sat there and listened, and I knew none of them knew anything about it. And I listened and I listened, and then I spoke up. And I said, you people are sitting here opinionating on something. Do any of you really know what it is?
Mm-hmm.
They were like drawing off the energy of the sort of hate.
And did that get you what you wanted? Did that get you the love that you wanted?
It gave me. It certainly drew some adrenaline.
Right, and that may be what you needed at that moment. I understand. So Jay, you got to be a cold fart in a cold breeze. You can't be a warm one.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling in.
Okay. Thank you, Armin. Thank you. Bye.
What an image.
They're good images, both of them. Grenade rather than a flag, right?
Yeah.
You want to wave a flag, that's okay. You throw a grenade in the middle.
That's a little more aggressive.
Right, that's what people do. 212-957-2729. There are places where loyalty becomes such a big issue. Loyalty and faithfulness, and you got to be around the same thing, and you got to protect, and it's a... it becomes very difficult for people to voice an opinion that's different.
Yeah, I mean, loyalty is important, I think, in everyone's life on one level or another, whether it's within the family, whether it's within the workplace, inside of a group, whether it's a religion, nationality. People value loyalty because it provides sort of like stability and predictability and assurance. That's what people like about it. It feels safe.
Let's take another call here. Hi, Ling. This is Armand Mill.
Hi, Armand.
Hello,
Happy Hanukkah.
Ling.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Okay, I'm calling because the tables were turned on me once when we were all in the lounge at work, and they were really cutting up one of the women who was apparently married and had was having an affair. So the room was very full, and I said, hey, you bunch of cowards, why don't you say this when she's here? You got some nerve. You treat her real nice when she's in front of you, but now you're cutting her up. How dare you? And a dead silence. They walked out of the room. I was never, ever invited to lunch, to dinner, to anyone's house anymore. And I was, just not talked with or only when it absolutely necessary. And it lasted forever, actually. And then one day there was a problem, and then a woman approached me, and I said, well, why do you come to me? Why don't you go to the people that you can discuss this with? And she said, oh no, we all know we can trust you. You don't know how much people respect you here. And I said, what? Well, because they say if you want anything ever to really be truthful or really happen, really take place in a positive way, you got to speak to Ling. And I said, what? And I said, oh, I don't understand. And she said, no, really, people really respect you. And then very long time afterwards, another colleague approached me because there was a big project, and she wanted me to be part of it. And I said, listen, it's okay. You can meet with me, but it's okay. I'll give you whatever information you want, but I really won't meet with the group, And, you know, she said, no, people really respect you. And again, it was there, but it was never apparent in the way they treated me. And, you know, and many times, even, you know, right next to me, they would say, oh, let's go to lunch, you know, at such and such a place, you know. And they would say right next to me, and they would all turn around and leave. And they would walk by, you know, my room and, you know, would not invite me. And this went on forever.
Well, let me ask you something about you and sure. your family. Where do you stand in your family group? Are you one of many children?
Three.
Three children. Two uh-huh. girls, other girls?
No, one female and one male.
Okay, where did you stand in the family?
I'm in the middle.
You're in the middle. So what uh-huh. was that like?
Oh, it was very, very difficult.
Yes, that's what I hear.
Mm-hmm,
what was the difficulty of your middle position?
Well, there was a lot of abuse and a lot of problems in the family. And I wasn't the only one who received the showering. But it was painful. I made peace with my parents before they passed.
But you never really had a family.
To the public, it seemed beautiful and perfect and wonderful, but then at home behind closed doors, it was really very painful.
Now, Ling, currently, do you feel that you're part of any family?
Oh, yeah. I got a great family now.
Tell me about your family
yeah.
now.
Oh, yeah. I'm wonderful. Very, very close to our daughters, grandchildren, my husband. Yeah.
So that took quite a jump for you to go from that one family that you had to another family. But people like you usually have great social difficulty because they don't know how to stand out there and to be themselves. See, you have this kind of integrity about yourself that you like to hold on to. And that integrity sometimes catches you. It catches you because you know, you don't know how to give the room to it. And I think what you did was honorable in saying it the way you said it, you know, and that you did separate the people. You did tell them, you know, if you're going to be gossiping, don't do it around me. And you took away one of their major weapons or the major food that they had at their gossip table. And you said, I am me, you know, and this is who I am. And they kind of showed you the respect for it. But in the future, you'll find also there's another way of doing the very same thing without having to interrupt what they're doing. But to bring about another position of it without the, you know, how dare you, instead of how dare you, say, well, I see that you, but let me tell you this. And you show your respect and your love, and you add it to the formula. See,
thank you.
And that
thank
works
you.
Well.
That's, wow. Yeah, thank you, Armand. By the way, I thank you because I went to you a very long time ago. And you helped me through a very difficult time.
I do remember you, Lynn. Yeah. I do remember you, and I'm glad you got through that.
Thank you, Armand. Thank you. You be well. Enjoy every minute.
This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. So, in talking about loyalties, it's a funny thing. I grew up in a family where, you know, I grew up in a family, part Sicilian, where there was loyalties talked about all over the place, and that was one thing. But I kind of stepped outside of that. And I always stepped outside of the group that was, the basis of the loyalty was repression. I didn't want to do that. But we do have something to share with you that we think is valuable. We're going to take a short break. When we come back from our break, I'm going to play you this little part. And then we'll continue our discussion and take your phone calls at 212-957-2729.
Take it, gentlemen.
Hi, I'm David Kenny, inviting you to join me Sunday, December 14th at 3 p.m. for the Everything Old is New Again Holiday Concert. It's a benefit for WBAI at the Metropolitan Room at 34 West 22nd Street in Manhattan. Lots of great talent, great music, door prizes, giveaways, and more. That's the Everything Old is New Again Holiday Concert on Sunday, December 14th at 3 p.m. For more information and to buy tickets, go to give2wbai.org. That's give, the number 2, wbai.org. Come and enjoy.
You know, while your mother's cooking the macaroni today, I figure I'd sit down and talk to you since you're old enough. You know, it's time that you really realize what this family's all about. Because about this time is when you're going to be able to join in and earn some real money and real cash. But before you do that, I want to teach you a little bit about loyalty. The main name of this game is respect and loyalty. Family is a big thing when we do this kind of business. Everything is with respect. And when a family member gets out of line and another family don't like it, one thing leads into another, and the next thing you know, you're gone. And then you're just a memory of me. My heart's broke then. But you gotta remember, there's always family and loyalty. Loyalty is the main thing. Obviously, you know I don't make my money. I don't make all my cash from going to work every day. All these construction jobs we do and sanitation and private stuff is all from earning money through the family. And since you're of age now, I think it's time that I taught you what coming into the family and respect is all about. So the first thing you gotta learn is the name respect. That means you don't cross somebody, you don't go over the line. Once you go over that line, there's no coming back. Whether you're a member of a family or not, that's when people get whacked. And we don't want nobody whacked in our family. So I gotta teach you the proper way of respect. When you're earning money, everybody earns. Everybody eats bread. It's all about cash money. That's what it's all about, making the money. So the first thing of business is this. You remember your name, you don't forget your roots. You never ever disrespect anyone that's above you. Especially your capo, especially the big time guys. Those are the guys you listen to. You never ever disrespect anyone unless you're told to. Unless you get the okay. And if there's no sit down, there's nothing.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Rick. Happy birthday to you.
It's Rick's birthday today, and Rick is one of our greatest supporters and has helped us build this studio, right, and is related to some of our studio people here.
Yes, actually, that Rick is my dad. Hi, Dad.
And my cousin.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you, Rick.
Happy birthday in the family.
And a big supporter of WBAI. Have you met Rick yet?
I haven't.
You will. You will soon. We have on the line, we have Dario. Hi there. Hi, you're on the line. Hello.
Hi.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
I could barely hear you. Are you on a strange phone line, Dario?
No.
Okay, so tell me what you want to say, Dario. Well, maybe you should compose your thought and call back at another time. Well, we'll speak to you another time then. Okay, do call back, yes. 212-957-2729. It's funny, people get stage fright when they get on the phone sometimes. 212-957-2729. Now, the piece we heard was Birdman and Lil Wayne, who are mocking or talking about an idea of what the family life is within the mafia. That's what they were talking about. And, but there is this kind of thought of honor that takes place that has got some validity in it, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, like we said before, I think loyalty makes people feel good because it conveys and implies a stability and a continuity, things that people can count on. And we all want to feel safe and, like, not predictable, but everyone wants to feel like they can count on.
Well, you know, one of the worst...
Yeah, a certain degree of certainty.
One of the worst things a person could do as a parent is to say things to their child, you know, don't tell daddy, don't tell mommy, that kind of thing, really separates it. you know, that really separates it. Let's give Dario a second try here. Hi there, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that very much.
Sure.
I just really appreciate the opportunity to be here. I think everybody was, it just so happens, and I'm just so thankful that I was able to be on the line here and listen and be available to speak and just be amongst great people like you all.
Oh, Dario, thank you so much. How do you spell your name? Well, I just want to pronounce it right. Is it Dario?
It's fine. Yeah. I'm just happy that I was kind of listening and I was excited and then as I was coming along, I was getting upset and it was just a lot of mixed emotions, but the loyalty factor that you were discussing and is a great importance. And not telling mommy, not telling daddy, those things are so delicate also.
Right, that happened to you when you were a child, right? Were you split in between two parents?
No, not at all. In some ways, but not in all its technicalities. It's hard to describe, but what's so important at this time and this, what's so much more valuable to me, is just be able to create an idea or a mindset or a frame, a picture rather, than to retell a story.
Yes, I hear. That's quite beautiful. And you have that picture in your mind, right? You have that picture?
I have that picture. Basically, it's beating in my heart. It beats every day. I try to visualize it daily, but not necessarily can it come together all the time positively, because it's a constant struggle. It's a constant battle. And I think at the beginning of all this, it was done beautifully. And, you know, not everybody can describe this matter in a way that they want to all the time. So
Dario, do you have people around you? Do you have people who you're close to?
Not as how I would like them to be, no.
No, you'd like people to be a little closer.
Of course.
But it's very hard to trust people, isn't it?
No, I don't think it is.
So what do you think separates you from people?
Pardon?
What do you think separates you from people?
I think people do the separating.
People do the separating from you. So then if they do, that makes it hard to trust them. That's what I'm saying. You know, they'll leave you. You're afraid that they'll leave you.
More so than an unforgiving mind and heart.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I can see you've been through a very difficult, damaged life, you know. But yours is the kind of story where we would like to talk a little further about it, more than on the radio station. Maybe you should send me an email, describe what you're talking about. And
sure.
I'll feed back to you, okay? It's armand@thepositivemind.com.
Okay,
I could hear, and so very nice to have you on the radio with us, and I'm glad you joined these interesting minds with your interesting mind. Thank you for calling in. 212-957-2729. If you listen closely, my friends, if you listen real closely, you could hear the picture. 212-957-2729. So, Ben, Julian, do you speak badly about yourself? This is a very important question. How many of you, if you were to write down, you know, your traits, would you say you're talking well about yourself or you're talking badly about yourself? People who talk badly about themselves are in general depressed. See, and they're criticizing this thing. Imagine that there's a child inside you, and this child is just sitting there and waiting for you to love it in some way, and instead you criticize it, you criticize it, you criticize. How do you think that child feels? It wants to be in hiding all the time. So that's why it kind of keeps depressed. It keeps away from you. And that's why you want to try to be a little more kind to yourself and say good things about yourself. Now, I'd like to hear somebody call who could say some good things about themselves. I'd like to hear you say three positive things about you. 212-957-2729. Let's take Scott. Scott, you're on the line.
Oh, hi, Armand. How are you?
Good. Did you get my questions?
I did, but I forgot them a little bit already. I kind of wanted to talk a little to the contrary about the gossip and things like that. Is that okay?
Sure.
Yeah, so the reason I was thinking is there must be some value to the negativity that goes on to those kind of things, and what kind of value is coming around from that. And I'm not quite sure where it leads, but, you know, sometimes you get tired of...
Are you a part of it? Are you part of the negativity?
No, I don't think so. I enjoy contrary thinking and funny dilemmas and like to analyze things a bit. But
Scott, tell me three good things about you.
Oh, I'm open-minded.
Okay,
I'm happy.
Stop with that for a minute. Hold on. Let's do one at a time. I'm open-minded. Okay, you like that about yourself, don't you, Scott?
Yeah.
Okay, what's the second thing?
I think I have a good relationship with my family.
Good relationship with your family. Good, honest relationship. Clear relationship with your family.
Well, yeah, within limits, right?
I don't know. It's your within limits.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, people have difficulties. We have to help them negotiate it. Being so candid and honest, it's not a straightforward thing all the time. If someone has problems and it's hard to navigate solutions or deal with the difficulties.
It sounds like you have a good relationship with your family. That's good. And what's the third thing about you, Scott?
I don't know. I love life. I feel lucky.
Mm-hmm. You know that part that you just said, I love life, I feel lucky?
Yeah.
You know, that's a big deal, isn't it?
Yes, because the lucky aspect of it is not so easy to share, or I wish other people were lucky, and what if I wasn't lucky?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I understand. I understand. I once met a man who was responsible for starting most of the game shows on television, came to see me, and he allows me to tell the story. He was depressed, but he started all these famous game shows on TV. So I said to him after a while, I said, you know, you have all this depression, but you have all these game shows. How did you ever get so many popular game shows successfully? And he said, because I'm lucky. And I said to him, you mean you carry luck with you? He says, yes, I carry luck with me everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And that's an interesting thing, to be depressed and lucky at the same time. Now, you're not depressed and you're lucky also, right?
Sure, and in theory, right? I mean, we all have emotional states, and I'm generally in a good mood.
Yeah, and what's the worst mood you ever get into?
Oh, when something just seems very illogical and you don't understand the barrier and there doesn't seem to be any understanding or way around the problem or things like that.
Because you can't find a logical answer to what seems to be an emotional difficulty, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's so difficult because it all makes sense. It's supposed to make sense because Scott likes to make sense out of things. He can line up the ducks.
No better than that.
Right?
But, you still try to put things in order, right?
And deeply emotional. And what are you doing being hysterical? I'm telling you the truth. There is all the evidence. Here's the... Right?
Well, I know, you know... Maybe I'm listening to you too much. I don't try to, like, beat anyone over the head with logic or history or patterns or things like that. You like to try to respond appropriately to things, right?
So, well, I did say before, I think you do have a good relationship with your family because I see that you could step back at times and be able to observe and know that you don't have to enter into every fray. You know, you don't have to be in every battle. But you can sometimes let it take
itself.
That's
mission impossible, but you know, you just try to pick your places. And you know, teachers have that expression, I think it's teaching moment or learning moment, things like that. And those are the things that, you know, if you have kind of insight, you could kind of work. And, of course, these things are so dynamic, you know, that's just kind of a theory in a way.
Okay, so my last question to you, Scott, is how long has it been since you've had a very close male friend?
Well, I've got a good friend, but he lives far away.
I meant a very close male friend.
Yeah, not much.
You ache for it, don't you?
Yeah, you're right.
I hear it.
You had some shows recently about this, and I recognize that as a gap. Yeah.
I hear you're a man of integrity, but I hear you're a man who's alone. You know, alone, kind of, you know, separate from other men. And I think there's something important about that. I think there's something vital about that because, you know, you're part of the tribe, but you're like the only one who's ahead of the tribe. And I think you have to be related to other men. I think you need that from the sound of it.
Yeah. How to get there is a question, right?
Well, I have access to it. So why don't you send me an email?
I will.
Send me an email and let's talk about that a little bit because you sound like somebody who misses his brothers.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
I know, I could tell. Okay, well, thank you very much for calling in.
Thanks, Armand.
Sure.
I love that notion of just recognizing why you're lucky, what we're lucky for. And when I start to get down, that's sort of how I've pulled myself out of it in the past, is just being thankful for the ways in which I'm lucky or I've been lucky.
Well, you know, part of depression is you forget about what's lucky. Part of depression is you're not allowed to see that.
Right.
That's help. It's when you're pulling yourself up that you see it. 212-957-2729. We've still got time for another call. So this idea of this respect that we want to put out there to as many people as we possibly could find, that's kind of what we're looking for at the moment. You know, we want to kind of, during the day today, to spread it along, probably do it through email, do it through a letter, do it through kindness. You know, a kindness of some kind, of some sort today, because every bit of it counts. It at least counts to make the world a little clearer, you know? It may not feed back to you immediately, but somehow it'll be fine to you. If you're kind to every animal, to every flower, to everybody around you, if you stop yourself from picking a flower just because you found it attractive and you wanted to pick it, then you stop yourself and you let it be there. Let's take one more call from Long Island. Here's Jason. Hi, Jason. You're on the line.
Hey, Armand. Thank you, Jason. I just wanted to honor you because in the midst of my adversity, you know, going through financial chaos with loan debt and going to default, I'm still able to go and listen to your radio, which is a lecture to me that I would get into college, but even better, and then also further research the techniques on my own. So I want to say thank you for that and to answer the question that was aforementioned.
Sure. Let me hear your answer.
Sure. The three characteristics is that I'm loving, perceptive, and giving.
Hmm. And now who is the closest male friend you have?
My closest male friend, I would have to actually say my pastor, actually, Terrence Chapman.
That's your pastor, right? Is there anybody who you consider to be a buddy?
Yes.
Tell me about that person.
My friend Junior, like, we knew each other since childhood, and we both have the same nationality. We're both Haitian descent.
Mm-hmm.
And we had very similar challenges. I remember it was either the second or third encounter where we actually got into a physical fight, but we understood one another because we both had temper problems, and we worked it out at the end and didn't put a rift in our initial acquaintanceship that built it, which later transformed into a strong, loving, brotherly bond. Even though we're not related by blood.
Jason, however, when's the last time you were in contact with him?
Oh, that was like last week.
Last week, okay. Now, the next time you speak to him, tell me three things about him that are wonderful.
Three things.
Three things.
Sure. He's also a giver, such as myself. He's also perceptive. And what makes him different is that he's not afraid to pull punches. He doesn't hold back. He'll just say it as is, regardless of being politically correct or not.
He doesn't pull punches.
Yeah.
Right? He doesn't. He just kind of comes out and says whatever he thinks. And exactly. You really appreciate that about him.
Oh, of course. I'd rather deal with individuals like that instead of someone who's, like, really covert about things. Just, I like someone who's a straight shooter. Period.
And what's his name?
His name is Josie Manelis.
Josie, wherever you are, there are a couple of million people now hearing good words about you. Somehow, your friend Jason is talking well about you. Now, can we imagine wherever Josie is, that he may not be listening to this program, but that little fingers of mellowness are kind of coming down to his shoulders like the angels are flittering down, and he feels better for some reason that he doesn't understand?
Yes, it's actually right there in the atmosphere. I'm sure he's receiving it in the spirit.
All right. And we'll send that over to you as well for being such a kind friend and such a good man.
All righty.
Thank you for calling in.
All right, peace.
212-957-2729. So we're the basis of this, what we've been putting on, the guy's name was, you might want to hear the lecture, Joel Osteen, O-S-T-E-E-N. He looks remarkably like Gary Null's brother. He really does. He really does. It's kind of amazing, a young Gary Null's brother. And he delivers himself very, very well. I do not believe in the religious part of it. You know, the way that part of it works, I'm not a part of the ministry, and I'm not in agreement with his humor or his politics, but what he had to say about this, to me, were kind of meaningful. And meaningful, I hope we could push it along here.
It's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube.
Yeah, just look up Joel Osteen Honor, 2014.
Joel Osteen Honor. Mm-hmm. Thank you both. So thank you. Thank you. This has been an interesting exploration, right? So people are going to try to turn this around in their own lives. And then I'd like you to report to us, if you would, about what your efforts have been to speak well about something, you know, and kind of see if you could make a change in some kind of a way in the world around you. Let me just take this one call from Marie Antoinette. How could I not?
Hello.
Hello, Marie Antoinette.
How are you? Happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
And what I want to say, I'm stage fright.
You have stage fright right now.
Yes, but what I want to say about gossiping, about talking, that my policy is never to tell anybody else if someone tell me something personal about themselves. And it's just between me and that person. But people very often tell about you, and also they change. They change accordingly to them, they change completely the meaning of the conversation or of something that you do. You understand?
Yes, I do understand, and it changes as
and that is very, sometimes it's very difficult to accept back. People tell you, and things don't exist. Actually, it's a fantasy or perception that person has.
Yes, and stories will always change. There's a thing called the telephone game, Marie Antoinette, which is very interesting, which is one person plays tells a story and they tell it to someone else, and then that person tells it to someone else, and it changes all along the way. In fact, the Bible was often thought of, the Bible has changed significantly because the people who used to translate the Bible did it by hand. And they would write, and each one would write it just a little differently and a little differently. So that's the nature of it. But if you put the energy in it, when you're speaking of something, to be sure that you're including the positive,
yes,
you find that the story does not change that often. It's when you throw in a little negative thing, that's the part that people exaggerate.
Not necessarily.
No, in your world.
It might be, because sometimes you tell something personal to the person.
Sure.
You know, but not necessarily. Things things change sometimes. I'm not saying all the time.
Yeah, well, it's nice to be here, isn't it?
Yes.
How do you like being on the air? How do you like speaking on the...
My bird is saying hello to you. He's right now playing in his little box.
Well, let me play something for your little bird. I'll say, what's his name?
Griffin. Remember he talked with you last time?
Oh, yes, I do remember Griffin. Well, here's a little music for Griffin. Thank you for calling very much, Marie Antoinette.
Thank you. I love you.
Okay. So this is for Griffin. It's armand@thepositivemind.com if you want to send me an email. Or you can Twitter me nowadays at Armand Dimelle, D-I-M-E-L-E, right? We'll be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m., my friends. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Julian.
Benefit concert for WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, hosted by Dalton Anderson of High Praise, Sunday mornings at 6 a.m. in association with J Blast Entertainment and Victory Christian Ministries presents A Night of Inspiration on Saturday, December the 13th. Doors open at 3 p.m., showtime 5 p.m. at Pilgrim Church of Brownsville, 572 Rockaway Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. Starring David Wright and the New York Fellowship Mass Choir, Roberta Moore, Ronell Fuller, Riley Spuhl and Holy Sound, B. Renee Barnes, Mark Reddick and Universal Praise, Anita Neely Wells, and Dr. Dramatic. For tickets, you can visit our website, give2wbai.org. Tickets are $20 in advance, $25 at the door, $30 VIP, and $35 VIP meet and greet. For additional information, you can also call 610-541-8615. A Night of Inspiration, a benefit concert for WBAI, Saturday, December the 13th, at Pilgrim Church of Brownsville, 572 Rockaway Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. Doors open at 3 p.m., showtime at 5 p.m., and I will be your MC.
All right, and the previous program was The Positive Mind with Armand Dimelle. You can listen to that program every Tuesday and Wednesday starting at 1 p.m. here on WBAI. Stay tuned for The Cutting Edge with Dred Scott Keys, where this particular show focused on the Black Arts Movement. And once again, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Listener-sponsored community radio since 1960. Stay tuned.
morning, and welcome to The Cutting Edge, where journalism, culture, politics, and activism converge. I'm Dred Scott Keyes.
Good old days were full of sunshine. Now they're full of rain. Your sounds feel so right and warm. Every time you touched her. Now his arms feel so cold and wrong. But he's your baby's father. What can you do about love? Hey, sunshine and rain, tears and laughter. Joy, pain, go home or stay before and after. Love, hey, sunshine and rain, tears and laughter. Joy, pain, go home or stay before and after.
The Black Arts Movement was once described by Time Magazine as the single most controversial moment in the history of African American literature, and possibly in American literature as a whole. It was started in Harlem by writer and activist Amiri Baraka. The movement was triggered by the assassination of Malcolm X, and among the well-known writers who were involved with the movement were Nikki Giovanni, Sonia Sanchez, Maya Angelou, Hoyt Fuller, and Rosa Guy. The movement is also seen as the most important times in African American literature. It inspired Black people to establish their own publishing houses, magazines, journals, and art institutions. Before the movement, the literary scene lacked diversity, to say the least, and the ability to express those ideas from the point of view of people of color. The Black Arts Movement changed that. It influenced the whole world of literature with the portrayal of different ethnic voices. Theater groups, poetry performances, music, and dance were centered on this movement, and therefore African Americans were becoming recognized in the areas of literature and art. African Americans were also able to educate others through different types of expressions and media about cultural differences. African American performances were used for political advertisement, organization, and community issues. This week, The Cutting Edge presents the second part of a series on the Black Arts Movement with the co-editors of a new anthology, SOS, Calling on All Black People. Featured are many of the movement's leading artists, including Ed Bullins, Nikki Giovanni, Woody King, Aki Mahabuti, Sonia Sanchez, Askia Toure, and Val Gray Ward, who remain artistically productive today. The movement's influence can also be seen in the works of later artists, from writers Toni Morrison, John Edgar Wideman, and August Wilson, to actors Avery Brooks, Danny Glover, and Samuel L. Jackson, to hip-hop artists Mos Def, Billy Quelle, and Chuck D. The anthology includes works of fiction, poetry, and drama, in addition to critical writings on issues of politics, aesthetics, and gender. It covers topics ranging from the legacy of Malcolm X and the impact of John Coltrane's jazz to the tenets of the Black Panther Party and the music of Motown. The Mega Evers Center for Black Literature this week hosted a discussion with the co-editors Sonia Sanchez and John H. Bracey Jr., who began by talking about the movement's founder, Amiri Baraka.
Whether you're talking about music criticism, first black man to write a full-scale, you know, analysis of African-American music. If you're talking about dramatists, he won every prize white people could give him, and when they stopped giving them to him, he still kept writing. Right? He kept right on stepping. He wrote poetry. Right? Wrote poetry up to the day he died. Right? Wrote poetry so good that he couldn't get tenure at Rutgers. You don't even know anybody in the English department at Rutgers. You can't name me one person. But they thought that they were better than Amiri Baraka, and he wasn't fit to belong with them. But he wasn't. He was better than them. They did him a favor. You know, why should he settle in with mediocrities? Right? It's Amiri Baraka that moved from the village, from downtown. One of the greatest of the beat poets. When you read the history of the beat movement and Baraka's name is not there, then check it out. You know, it's a whitewashing of that movement. He's the one that published the first beat anthology, The Martins. He's the one that collected all those white poets and put them into print, not the other way around. Right? But he left that world, you know, after Malcolm died, went north to Harlem and said, we're going to build a movement that will carry on Malcolm's legacy. We're going to take up that burden. Right? And he's a small man, tiny little man. He put that burden on his shoulders and he picked up Coltrane's burden too. Says, we're going to do the politics and the art. And that's what black arts is. And he called together all the great young poets. You know, all the older poets who used to, you know, write as Negroes and weren't so sure what was going on. So you get Gwendolyn Brooks saying, I don't think I'm a write for HarperCollins anymore. I think I'm going to go write with Broadside. There's $1 million worth of royalties down the tubes. Right? You leave, you turn over a contract that's paying you decent money to go to a press somebody's operating out of their basement. Said, no, 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 this is a black thing. We're going to do it. We're going to do this. Right? Great artists all across the country, you know, stop doing what they were doing. You know, stop painting birds and trees and waterfalls. I said, no, no, we're going to do a black thing. And that's what we talked about. This is a black thing, right? But we didn't know what it was. You know, there was no pamphlet that says how to be black in 5 easy steps, right? There was no pill you could take, like on the TV at night. Do you feel not black enough? Take one of these, right? That wasn't there. We had to do this on our own. So, of course, it's a messy movement. It's contradictory. People fight all the time. They argue. Right? We have to get Negroes to act in black, but nobody know what black meant. So that's where the art comes in. Right? You know you didn't want to be a Negro, but how do you act as a black person? Right? Well, then we talk about, well, who are we as a people? Where did we come from? You know, so Africa's very important. How do we express ourselves? So music is very important. The black women start to talk. For us brothers, it's like, whoa, we didn't know they thought that. We thought that black women poets were just like black men poets, except they were women, right? Were we surprised, right? Sisters got up on stage and started like, whoa, okay. Well, you got 2 things you can do. Why they messing with me, or am I that messed up? And your response should be, check yourself. If you're okay, then they're not talking about you. If they're talking about you, change. Right? Don't say it's not true. Don't jump on them for bringing it out. No, no. If you're wrong and they point it out, get right. That's what you're supposed to do. Now, why are they talking about their brother? Because their brother was wrong. And we didn't know they was wrong until they called us out. We thought we were just normal, regular people. We were socializing white bourgeois patriarchal norms, and that's the way we acted. Right? And nobody told us that till these black women got on the stage and said, you know, y'all acting like patriarchy pigs and blah, blah. It's like, whoa, okay. Check yourself. That's extremely important. Black female artists are extremely important. It's got nothing to do with the white feminist movement. This is totally separate from the white feminist movement. This is prior to the white feminist movement. Right? This comes out of black women asserting their role within a black community. Right? Calling black men, you know, to be themselves in a righteous way. To be a new world is not going to be the sisters in the kitchen. That's not happening. Right? A new world is not black women walking 3 steps behind. Right? And not hitting you in the back of your head while they're doing it. Right? A new world is how do we live as human beings together, you know, in a world that denies who we are as a people, you know. And we have defined ourselves as black people, and what we were going to do is work out in public, in front of millions of people, how that happened. So the audience is not literary critics. The audience is not somebody writing something in the New York Times. The audience is everyday people in the street. So you'd read your poetry, and there'll be 2,000 people jumping up and down, screaming the words back at you. You know, my favorite was the Mary's poem, you know, that poem for black hearts. So he gets to that great line, up against the wall, this is a stick up. Imagine 2,000 people in DeSalvo High School auditorium. Baraka stops talking. He's banging on the platform, banging, banging, banging. You can do it. You can do it. All you got to do is say the magic word. 2,000 people jump up because they know the words to his poem. Right? Like y'all know the words to the latest hip-hop thing. We knew the words to Black Art's poetry. Right? He's so cool, he even stops for green lights. Right, that kind of thing. The revolution would not be televised. You know, niggas afraid of revolution. I ain't going to say the rest of that one. Y'all got to read that for yourself. They got a lot of language in there. We also took white people's language and assaulted them with their own words. Turned the words back on them. Turned them upside down and created new forms of being. Right? Because we're trying to put ourselves together in public. You know, we didn't retreat to the top of a mountain. You know, we didn't go into a monastery. We didn't go into a convent. In public, we tried to figure out, if we're not Negroes, what does it mean to be black? And the Black Arts Movement was key to that. It was absolutely a fundamental key to that, and it was successful. It is so successful, nobody even thinks about being a Negro no more, and they think that's normal. Right? If we said a book about Negroes, you would say, like, what? Like, what? No, no, how come you don't call yourselves Negroes no more? And if I call you a Negro, that's an insult, right? Negro, right? Right? I'm messing with you when I say that. Right? But I can't call you black and you get mad. It used to be the other way around. Right? When I grew up, you call somebody black, they want to fight. I ain't black, I'm a Negro. Now you're a Negro. I ain't Negro, I'm black. Right? That's what Black Arts did. It walked us through that. Did we succeed all the way? Of course not. course not, right? Because powers saw the power of this, right? And they paid people to say that what we weren't, you know. They paid people to not do what they were doing, you know. They would keep a person like Baraka from getting just a regular job at a regular university, you know. They drove Sonia out of New York, you know. She couldn't get a job in New York City. You know, that's not an accident. That's deliberate, you know. They went after people who were great artists, you know, harassed them, kept them from making a decent living, tried to silence them. Didn't work. Didn't work. Because the power of the art was everywhere. You know, the power of the art was in the murals on the wall. It's in Nelson Stevens' painting, which is on the cover. We use Nelson's work. He was part of AfriCobra, black muralists. You know, Nelson produced these things on posters. It cost 50 cents, so you could put it up in your dorm room. Right? Black art was not in a museum on a wall. You know, black art is like on your body. It's on when you walk down the street. You know, if you're a college kid and say, I don't have any money for art, yeah, buy one of these posters and put it up. Cost you 50 cents. Hot off the press. Brand new black art. Good art. You know, not crap, good art. Right? You had to fight for the right to dress in a certain way. And like those, all those colors you used to wear were kind of boring, gray flannel suits and all that kind of stuff. All Levi had was one color, Levi, which is blue. You know, they had a brother, all of a sudden Levi got 25 different colors, right? That's the fact. That's how Levi switched from blue to all them colors. They say, well, how come black people don't wear Levi? Because you got one color, man. We don't do one color no more. Negroes, they have one color, and we're glad to have Levi's. Black people say, how come your Levi's are one color? Right? That's the black arts aesthetic, right? All that loud stuff they say, you can't wear that downtown? No, no, I'm wearing it downtown. Where are you going with all that stuff? And what is that anyway? This is what we wear when our people came from Africa. Yeah. Deal with it. Deal with it. Right? So look at yourselves. You couldn't have dressed this way in the 1950s or early 1960s. Your parents wouldn't let you out the house. Like, now you can wear any colors you want in any juxtaposition of forms you want. Like, you can use language as your language that speaks to you. Right? That was validated, you know, by poets like Sonia. You say, what are we bees about? Well, that's not correct English. No, no, no. But it speaks to who we are trying to be ourselves. What do we bees about? Right? That's an existential question. You know, Plato didn't say that. Right? We had to say that in our language for ourselves. Right? That's what the Black Arts Movement was all about. You know? And that's what I heard. A play was important if it moved me. Right? And you shouted at the play as it was going on, like y'all do it in the movies nowadays. Right? You talk with your character movie. Right? You go to Baraka's play, and if it's too complicated, you say, break it down, bro. Break it down. Like, come on. Make it real. Make it real. Like, what are you talking about? You know, what's this guy talking about? Break it down. So the next time you run the play, the artist makes it in a language that black people in the audience can accept. That's how you know you're reaching your audience. Right? Or you set up a play in a vacant lot, you know, with two lights up on a, you know, a wall like that. And you need five people to play the people in the background. So you get five guys. Say, come on, I need two of you. Give me a couple of them. Y'all are now in a play. Right? Here's the script. You say these lines. I'll tell you when to say them. And people could do that. Could do that. They wanted to do that. They were invested in doing that. You know. It was about them. Right? They didn't have to have, you know, acting class. They didn't need a dramaturg to tell them how to act like black people. Right? You had to draw what came out of them. And of course we had debates about what black meant. You know, does it mean we stop being African? You know, do we stop being Negro? Do I change my name? Do I not change my name? Well, I'm from Chicago. So when they said, well, you can't listen to the blues no more, I said, whoa, time out, time out. I'm gonna take Harley Whoop with me. Harley Whoop is black. I don't care where he come from, what he been. Harley Whoop is coming with me to blackness or I ain't going. Right? So you can somewhere else you can say you don't listen to blues, but that's not me. And then Baraka, of course, writes blues people. So I know I'm right. Right? Right? The leading black critic says, we are blues people. Well, I do that all along. But now I got it validated. Right? That's what black arts did. It put that debate in public, and we're still having that debate. Where did we come from? Who are we? What values do we have? How do we live in a world that denies our humanity? You know, how do we live among chaos and still survive? Because we do. You know, we're not a negative people. We might be beat upon, you know, we might be oppressed, but we look toward the future. Right? We're not a suicidal people. Right? You take away all the instruments in all the schools in New York, and brothers get a whole box of old vinyl and a turntable and make hip-hop. Right? Down south, they still got marching bands, so you don't need battle. You don't get no scratching out. You don't need that in Atlanta. They got it now, but early on, hip-hop comes out of the Bronx. There's no music in the schools anymore. We can't afford all those instruments. Hey, we don't need the instruments. We just want the sound. We can find that sound anywhere. That's the Black Arts Movement aesthetic. There's a direct connection between those people right now and the Black Arts Movement. When people say the Black Arts Movement didn't last long, just sleep. Close your eyes and listen. Mos Def, Talib Kweli, right? Common, right? Go back a little bit to Public Enemy. You know, We Righteous Teachers, Brand Nubian, KRS-One. Close your eyes. You know, Jessica Care Moore, Tony Medina. You hear it. That's the Black Arts Movement. I don't care what anybody says in a book about the Black Arts Movement. You hear it. You feel it. You know, when you walk among black people and people check you on how you relate to each other, that's a black arts aesthetic, you know, a black arts ethics is being brought into play, you know. And that's why we wanted this book out. There was too much nonsense out there, you know, and it's a big book because we wanted to give you, we didn't want to cherry pick. Could have been 10 times bigger, but the publisher wasn't going with that. So we, in fact, they barely went with this. We had to fight to keep the price down. It's only like $35, which is really cheap. Right, we owe them. We got to sell a lot of books. I'm just like an advertisement. We wanted the debates. The debates are in here. We have the organizational, you know, perspectives in here. You want to know what the Nation of Islam stood for? It's in here. You have to look at another book. It's in here. Right? You want to know what the Revolutionary Action Movement stood for? We have their manifesto in here. Black Panther Party is in here. Us is in here. Right? Because you can't separate the politics from the art. They don't belong in two separate books. Right? So as you work toward aesthetic fights, you see they're political fights, and we put them in the same book, you know. And you see that there's different types of artists. They don't all write the same thing. You can see the beauty of the work. These are people that if they wanted to write trees, could write beautiful poems about trees. They wanted to. They're great craftspeople, you know. Everybody's not great, but every white artist is not great, you know. Every white composer is not Beethoven. There's a lot of people that do stuff you don't want to hear. So everybody is not great, but the body of this work will hold up to the body of any aesthetic movement this country has ever produced. You know, the body of it. You know, all of it. You get this and get me another anthology and come up with stuff that's equal to this. You know, and that's the challenge. You get me an anthology of any movement of poets anywhere in the world, they will come up, you know, to the range, the complexity of this, you know. That's what the Black Arts Movement was, right? You know, I have a short piece in the end about being the audience, and the whole thing is about I was one of those people that heard them when they called. You know, I was a Negro who's now black, trying to find my way to blackness, you know, and without the Black Arts Movement, I'd still be thrashing around, right? But I knew enough, right, that, okay, this is a journey I'm going on, right? And the journey's not over. So the challenge of the book, you know, SOS is a distress signal. You know it is. If you're on a ship, the ship's going down, you send out a SOS. Right, save our ship, or as the brother would say, save our whatever, right? Or sink or swim, right? It's still a distress signal. We ain't home yet. We haven't anchored yet, right? Black arts can help you save your ship, right? Save ourselves, sink or swim, because we haven't anchored yet, right? This struggle is not over, right? This is not nostalgia we're pushing here. You know, we're talking about a movement that can still help you understand the world you live in right now. Right? The call is right now. SOS is still a distress call. We're still in distress. Right? And just carrying the book around should remind you. You look at that and say, how am I doing today? SOS, we're still in trouble. Right? Think about that. So I'll stop with that. I think I blew my 10 minutes a little bit longer. But thanks a lot.
It's a poem for Larry Neal and Bob Marley, two black cultural workers that we lost in 1981.
Whalers are we. We are whalers. Don't get scared. Nothing happening but out and way out. Nothing happening but the positive unless you the negative. Whalers. We whalers, yeah, whale, yeah, whalers. We whale, we whale. We could dig Melville on his ship, confronting the huge white mad beast, speeding death across the sea to we. But we whalers, we can kill whales. We could get on top of a whale and whale. Whalers, undersea defense hot folk. Blues babies humming when we arrive. Boogie ladies strumming our black violet souls. Rag daddies come from the land of never say die. Reggae workers bringing the funk to the people of I. We whalers, all right. Hail to you, Bob Man. We will ask your question all our lives. Could you be loved? I and I understand. We see the world. Eyes and eyes say yes to transformation. Whalers, I, whalers, subterranean night color magis working inside the soul of the world. Whalers, eyes, seeing the world's being. Hey, Bob, whale on, rock on. Yeah, come into us as real vision and action. Hey, Larry, whale on with Lester and the pork pie, whaling us energy for truth. We whalers is all, and on past that to say, whaling for all we worth, rhythm folks obsessed with stroking what is with our sound purchase. Call me Theolonius in my crowded whale vessel. I hold the keys to the funk kingdom. Lie on me if you want to. Tell folks it's yours. But for real whaling, not tale telling, the sensitive know who the whalers be. We whalers, blue blowers, the real rhythm kings. We sing philosophy, hambone precise findings, image masters of the syncopated. Whalers and drummers, whalers and trumpet stars, whalers and box cookers, whalers and sax flyers, whalers and bass thumpers, whalers and hey, whale, whale, we whalers, trombone bends. Magic singers, Ellingtonians, the only trains faster than rocket ships. Cut a rocket in our pocket and put a cord on the wall of the wind. Whalers, can you dig whaling? Call me Bud Powell. You want to imitate this? Listen. The calling card, the dialectic of silence, the sound approach. Life one day will be filled even further with we numbers, we song. But primitive place now, we whaling be kept underground. But keep it in mind, call me something dukish, something sassy. Call me by my real name when the world change. We whaling be in it, help make it for real time. Call me, I call you, we call we say, hey whalers, hey whalers, hey 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 whalers, whale on.
Going through the air, such a natural mystery. Going through the air, such a natural mystery. Hello, how are you? It is so good being here always at Mega Evers. And we want to thank Dr. Brenda Green for this invite to come here and to be a part of this great school. Sometimes I don't think you know how great you are and how important you are, you know, and how you came into being and how many of us saw this school come into being and always supported it because we understood what it was to have grassroots people, people coming into a university to say, I'm going to learn something. I'm going to be something. You know, I'm going to be in a place where named after Mega Evers. I mean, can you imagine that? Just the idea of walking into a school with the name Mega Evers and that history and history is amazing. I just wanted to say a couple of things that I guess I was blessed to be born when I was born. I was blessed also to be what I call a New Yorker, before they put my behind out of New York. I was blessed to also to have been in New York when Brother Baraka decided to come back uptown to Harlem to live from the village. And he sent out a letter to all the artists, the musicians, the painters, the writers, and the letter said, come, come, let us continue Malcolm's work. Isn't that amazing? And we call ourselves the children of Malcolm. Isn't that amazing? And we dated ourselves AM after Malcolm. If you really want to understand that, that's who we were, the children of Malcolm and after Malcolm. And so we came up to a place called Harlem. You know, they bought this house there, 131st Street and Brownstone. And I was the one who wrote all of the work for the children. So for the children, we would bring the children there on Saturday mornings and afternoons to teach them. That was the place also where you saw some of Baraka's first one-act plays, right? And we saw the great musicians, the greatest black musicians came into that place and played. The greatest black artists, the painters, came in and taught classes. It is that in that place, too, in Harlem, that a woman by the name of Abby Lincoln came one Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. and did a lecture called Who Will Revere the Black Woman? Whoa. I can still see her now because there were some shadows coming in too, sun coming in and shadows coming in, and she had this very short natural, and all we could do is just stare at this gorgeous, beautiful woman talking about who will revere the black woman. And this woman began to talk to us, and the more she talked, the straighter we set up, you know? The more we set up and we put our backs back and our spines got longer and stronger. And we stood up at the end because we knew we were beautiful because she had said we were beautiful. Isn't that amazing? That was Abby Lincoln.
You're tuned to The Cutting Edge and a discussion with co-editors John H. Bracey Jr. and poet Sonia Sanchez of SOS, Calling on All Black People, a new anthology on the Black Arts Movement. I'm Dred Scott Keyes.